Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
There's this case from 1867 that historians still argue about because the main suspect was already dead.
And not just casually deceased. We're talking about a prime suspect who was, you know, consumed by fire and ash, publicly declared gone.
Right.
And her remains, along with her entire life's work, were just reduced to rubble. Yet the systematic killing spree only began after she was gone.
Exactly. So our mission today is to really do a deep dive into the mystery of Miss Applebottom and the dark, frankly, almost ridiculous consequences of overdue library books in Port Royal, 1867.
It sounds absurd on the surface.
It does. We have this incredible stack of sources, mostly police logs and down records from right after the local conflict. And they paint a very strange picture.
It's a terrifying lesson in what you might call organizational persistence. It forces you to ask, when does a set of rules, a person's rigid adherence to them, become so powerful that it actually transcends the mortality of the person who made them?
You mean the system just keeps running on its own?
Precisely. The sources detail a system so entrenched, it apparently just kept operating, independent of, you know, physical life. It's chilling.
And before we get into the strangulations, which we will, we really need to set the scene. Port Royal, 1867. This wasn't a peaceful little town at the time.
No, and that context is absolutely crucial. Port Royal was situated perilously close to a significant ongoing conflict.
So there's a war happening nearby.
A war. You have the external pressure of a battle, the pervasive sound of cannon fire often drifting over the town. There's this generalized societal chaos gripping the whole region. I mean, life was cheap. And unpredictable violence was just the norm.
So high stress, high volatility. The community is focused on this massive existential threat coming from the outside.
Right. And against this backdrop of external disruption and violence, you had this one institution, the library, which represented the absolute uncompromising opposite.
Mundane order.
Mundane, unyielding order. Miss Applebottom's strictness wasn't just an eccentric personality trait. It was an extreme, almost pathological devotion to structure that served as a bizarre kind of psychological anchor for the community.
Yeah.
Even if that anchor was, well, terrifying.
An anchor that, in this case, held onto the seabed of the living world with a supernatural grip. This whole story really explores accountability, how artifacts can persist, and the frightening transformation of a rigid bureaucratic system into a haunting presence.
A presence that demanded ultimate closure for, of all things, mundane errors.
Yeah.
What's truly unsettling here is that the town was dealing with the unimaginable chaos of war, but the thing that ultimately terrorized them most was the return of the hyperimaginable,
okay.
An unpaid overdue fine.
It completely shifts the threat, doesn't it?
It does. It moves from the random malice of a faraway enemy to the hyper-specific targeted malice of a local system they thought they understood.
Yeah.
And they thought was gone.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the central figure herself. Let's talk about Miss Applebottom. The sources describe her as the strict 94-year-old librarian of Port Royal.
94.
In 1867, that is an exceptional age. I mean, that's decades of accumulated authority and just absolute certainty in your methods.
Her age alone signifies a kind of generational dominance over the town's literary life. Just think about that longevity for a second.
Mm-hmm.
She had seen people born, grow up, borrow books from her, move away, and then their children come back to borrow books. She'd likely been the librarian longer than most of the residents had even been alive.
So she's almost a mythic figure even before all this happens.
Exactly. It gives her this eternal status, commanding respect and, well, certainly fear.
And this wasn't some standard, you know, public municipal service. The sources state she owned thousands of books.
Yeah, that's a key detail.
Which suggests this wasn't just her job. It was her private domain, her kingdom, built on paper and binding. She was the absolute monarch of literacy and, far more importantly to the story, of timeliness.
The ownership detail is paramount. It means her authority wasn't derived from the town council or any kind of civil service regulations. Her rules were personal law.
Her law.
Backed by the implicit threat of losing access to her unique collection. If the town was reliant on her for knowledge or entertainment, they were entirely subject to her whims. You entered her space under her terms, period.
And those terms were apparently terrifying. She's described as running her library with an iron fist. This wasn't passive enforcement.
No, this wasn't just sternness. It was active, aggressive enforcement that was central to her identity. The signature behavior detailed in the surviving town accounts is extreme.
Which was what exactly?
Anyone who returned a book even a minute late got screamed at loud enough for half the town to hear.
A minute late. Wow. So that's institutionalized public shaming as a preventative measure.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine the walk of shame crossing the town square, carrying a slightly late book, knowing the tirade that awaited you.
And the sources suggest this wasn't just a sharp word. It was a full-throated, ear-splitting barrage that targeted your character, not just your poor time management.
It created this palpable, chilling culture of fear around the simple act of borrowing a book.
It really did. The consequences just outweighed the benefit. Why risk the humiliation of a 94-year-old woman screaming that you are a moral failure because you kept the last of the Mohicans for an extra day?
It changes the whole point of a library.
It fundamentally changes the perceived value of the book itself. It's no longer about accessing literature. It's about accepting an extreme contractual obligation under the threat of public, violent denunciation.
Let's analyze that psychological contract she enforced. You said she was the embodiment of order, rules, and due dates in human form. What does that extreme rigor tell us about her worldview?
I think to Miss Applebottom, lateness wasn't just an inconvenience or a slight oversight. It was a moral failing.
Right, a sign of lax character.
A breach of sacred trust. And a symptom of fundamental societal decay. In her mind, the rules of the library were a microcosm of the rules of civilization itself.
And given the conflict raging just outside of town, she had evidence all around her that society was, in fact, decaying.
Exactly. The war underscored her deepest fear, the complete collapse of order. In this unstable, violent time, she found absolute stability in the rigid, predictable structure of her ledger and the calendar.
So the due dates were her defense against chaos.
They were. For her, the rules weren't just guidelines. They were sacred, and adherence to them was the only thing preventing total chaos. She saw herself as the final bulwark against that chaos, and the overdue fine was the first step on the road to ruin.
Therefore, the fine had to be enforced with absolute total severity.
Yes. The intensity of her personality means she didn't just enforce the rules, she became the physical manifestation of the rules themselves.
And that is the foundational point for understanding what happens after the fire, isn't it?
It is. If she viewed the rules as sacred, then the punishment for breaking them must also be sacred, and therefore necessary, regardless of who was delivering it, or whether they're technically alive.
She invested so much personal will, rage, and focus into this system.
The ledger, the deadlines, the meticulous nature of her record keeping. The system itself gained an independent, self-sustaining momentum from her.
This is why her personality matters so much to this deep dive. If she had been a mild-mannered librarian, the subsequent murders would just be a mystery solved by finding, you know, a jealous neighbor.
Right.
But because she was this relentless enforcer, the murders instantly gained this horrifying context of organized systemic retribution.
We talk often about artifacts outliving their creators, you know, old contracts or forgotten technologies, but rarely do we see the enforcing personality itself persist as a functional murderous ghost or a self-executing process.
So her life was defined by the relentless pursuit of order.
And death, apparently, was just a temporary administrative hurdle for her. The physical body was removed, but the regulatory spirit remained.
Okay, the stage is set. We have a town terrified of a fine and a librarian who believes that a late book signals the end of civilization. Now, let's move to the event that should have ended her tyranny. It's April 18th, 1867. The environment outside Port Royal is saturated with the sound of the nearby battle. The community is dealing with mass trauma, focused on the random nature of military violence.
They are bracing for a threat that is distant and indiscriminate. But fate, or, you know, maybe cosmic irony, had a far more specific target within the town walls.
And the catalyst, a stray cannonball smashed into her library.
Talk about a collision of worlds.
Right. The immense random chaos of war collides directly with the meticulous, highly controlled order of Miss Applebottom's world.
The irony is breathtaking. I mean, she spent her life defending the town against the small chaos of a late return, only to be struck down by the ultimate random chaos of a stray artillery shell.
The impact must have been just devastating.
Instantly. structurally compromising the building, shattering glass, splintering wood, and the consequence was immediate.
Fire.
The blaze spread too fast for anyone to help her. The town could only watch as the central pillar of their local culture and their local fear was just consumed.
You can just imagine the smoke, the smell of thousands of burning books, the structure collapsing into a pile of charred debris.
After the search in the ruins, Ms. Applebottom and her entire collection were officially declared deceased.
And the record keeping is so haunting there, they didn't just declare her dead.
No, they declared the collection deceased. They treated the volumes as an extension of her own life force, a single entity wiped from existence.
I can imagine the town's reaction being complex. You know, there was the necessary respect for a death and a tragic accident, but beneath that...
Oh, there must have been a quiet, profound wave of relief.
Right. The screeching enforcer of order, the source of systemic terror, was finally gone. That chapter was closed. And perhaps they could finally return Moby Dick 6 days late without consequence.
They certainly felt closure. The source material implies the town was beginning to breathe again, trying to move on, maybe even quietly celebrating the end of their systemic anxiety.
And that sense of relief is what makes the transition into the next act so disturbing.
Mm-hmm. A few days later, things in Port Royal took a very dark turn.
The posthumous murders began. Describe the pattern that emerged in the days immediately following the fire.
Several residents were found deceased in their beds, and the method was precise, intimate, and horrifyingly consistent across all the victims.
What was it?
They were strangled in their sleep.
We need to dwell on the crucial details provided in the sources there. The lack of evidence of struggle or noise. No signs of struggle, no noise.
None.
So if we are dealing with a human killer, what does that imply?
Well, if it was a living perpetrator, it suggests extreme stealth, incredible physical force combined with complete silence, or a total element of surprise. The killer must have been either extremely adept at their craft or maybe known to the victim.
Allowing them to get close.
Right, to gain access without raising an alarm. But the sheer silence is the most terrifying part. It just eliminates any possibility of defensive action.
Okay, but what if we operate under the presumption that Miss Applebottom or her system was the culprit?
Then it suggests an entity capable of silent, intimate intrusion and immense targeted force that just defies physical reality.
And strangulation is so personal, it's a hands-on method of killing.
It is, which deeply contrasts with the random, impersonal efficiency of the cannonball that killed her. The method of retribution chosen by the system is intimate violence targeted for a bureaucratic failure.
The victims went to sleep, supposedly safe from the external war, only to be executed in the most intimate way possible for an internal administrative failure.
The violence is intimate, but the motivation is cold bureaucracy. The terror is amplified because the community was ready for war to kill them. They were not prepared for the library system to kill them.
And this targeted, systematic pattern of death only clicked for the police when they investigated the scenes and found something chilling.
The ultimate clue.
This is where the paper artifact becomes the central piece of evidence. They discovered a handwritten list of 7 names.
This is the cold, hard proof of the system actively continuing its work. The list is the physical remnant of her iron fist.
And this wasn't just a ledger. Each name was accompanied by the title of a borrowed book and an overdue date.
The meticulousness is terrifying. Even in death, or perhaps because of her dedication to the system that transcended death, she maintained this perfect record keeping.
It confirms the motive beyond any doubt. This wasn't random violence or a robbery or a wartime act. These people died because they held onto a copy of Frankenstein for too long.
It elevates the tragedy to a level of profound bureaucratic horror. And the status update was the most horrifying detail of all.
What was that?
Every single name on that list was crossed out.
The crossed out name. That's the administrative act of completion. It transforms a murder into a task checked off a list.
The list itself is operating as the new executor of the system. It survived the fire and became the new tool of retribution, dictated by the relentless will of its creator.
So that's the aha moment for the police and for us. The rules, the fines, the records, the system outlived the human being.
The artifact, that handwritten list, was animated by the sheer focus rage of Miss Applebottom. The list, therefore, becomes the new murder weapon, dictating who lives and who dies based entirely on a date stamp.
That contrast between the mundane failure of a late book and the horrifying consequence of death by strangulation is what makes this case so persistent. It gives ultimate final weight to every minute past the deadline.
It confirms that for Miss Applebottom, the rules were literally a matter of life and death, and that belief persisted beyond her grave.
So the police are faced with this, a list of victims who died by strangulation, and the only common thread is a deceased librarian who is notoriously obsessed with fines. What are the possibilities they're considering?
I mean, you have to imagine the confusion. They had to contend with really three possibilities. First, the supernatural, a ghost, a haunting. Miss Applebottom's residual spirit, fueled by rage, is physically enforcing the contracts.
Which explains the stealth and the impossible nature of the killings. No noise. But it's a huge leap of faith, especially for a police force in 1867.
Right. So the second possibility is a living killer. An accomplice, a former employee, maybe a copycat, someone who found the list and decided to finish her work.
That explains the strangulation, the physical act, but it doesn't explain the silence, the lack of struggle, and the motive is just so bizarre.
Exactly. Which brings us to the third and maybe the most terrifying possibility.
Systemic inertia.
The system, the list, the idea, the fine became a self-executing force. Not a ghost, necessarily, but an environmental consequence of her obsessive will that manifested in violence.
The killer, whatever its form, is just following administrative protocol.
The list dictates the action, removing all humanity from the violence. They were executed not because they were hated, but because they were next on the ledger.
The police, realizing their main suspect is officially a pile of ash, must have been completely confounded. They had to return to the source of the system to find the infrastructure that could explain this anomaly. So the investigators returned to the burned-down library ruins. The fire had done its work, reducing thousands of books and all that wood to charcoal, but they knew the systemic terror hadn't been erased.
Right. The first search was about finding remains, assessing damage. This second search, fueled by the terrifying realization of the list, was about finding administrative infrastructure.
And this time, they found something. They realized her operation wasn't entirely visible to the public. They found a key physical anomaly.
A scorched bookcase that doesn't quite match the wall behind it.
That detail is so crucial. The slight misalignment, maybe a different burn pattern, or an awkward fit against the plaster. It hints at secrets that predated the fire. It implies deception.
Why would a strict librarian, the public face of order, maintain a secret hidden space? The hidden door suggests two layers to her strictness. The public layer was the screaming, the humiliation, the loud, visible enforcement designed to scare people into compliance. But this hidden layer, the secret administration, implies a place for more. Private matters.
This is where the true, unforgiving ledger of debt was kept.
And perhaps where she prepared her most severe forms of retribution, far from public scrutiny.
They moved the bookcase, revealing a hidden door, which led to a staircase descending into a basement no one knew existed.
And that immediately changes the nature of the investigation. This isn't just an accidental death followed by random murder anymore. This is a highly organized clandestine operation.
A secret basement beneath the ruins of the public library. It's a structural representation of her personality, isn't it? The public facade of literature masking a deep, unknown, and presumably sinister system below ground.
It means she was not just eccentric. She was actively, deliberately hiding something fundamental about her process from the entire town.
Now we get to the core of the mystery that historians still debate. The source material emphasizes the lingering silence surrounding what was in that basement. What they saw down there has never been fully revealed.
The fact that the details were suppressed or never shared speaks volumes. It suggests something so profoundly disturbing about her actual private operation that it transcended mere evidence of a crime.
It wasn't just records.
No. It must have been evidence of a system so bizarre, so perverse, or so horrific that the authorities felt it defied public explanation and would only fuel greater panic or superstition.
Let's explore the speculation. Given her obsession with fines and due dates, what might they have found that was so disturbing it had to be suppressed?
Well, if the list represented a sequence of executions, the basement might have represented the sequence of punishments leading up to death. Perhaps they found physical restraints, tools used for humiliation taken to an extreme degree.
Or maybe a system of detailed surveillance, something that allowed the killer, living or otherwise, to track the victims without alerting them.
That's one prevalent theory. Another is that the basement contained a comprehensive catalog of every interaction she had with every late borrower. Not just the name and book, but handwritten details about their character flaws, their excuses, their moral decay as she perceived it.
A ledger that was almost judicial in its scope.
Decades of resentment and administrative focus, all in one place. But the silence, whatever the reason for it, maintains the eerie folklore quality of the story. The town doesn't need to know the specifics. They only need to know that the secret was too terrible to be spoken aloud.
The only thing that truly pierces that veil of silence is the final testimony. We have to rely on the words of the last surviving officer on the case years later. This officer carried the burden of that unrevealed truth until his deathbed.
It's a classic folklore trope, but here it's backed by police records, a sworn testimony of a dying man. He finally admits one crucial detail about their descent into that secret basement.
Deliver the chilling line that concludes the physical investigation,
he said. She wasn't down there. She was behind us.
She was behind us. That simple statement just shatters the material reality of the case entirely. It doesn't just confirm she wasn't contained by the fire or the ruins.
No, it suggests that the moment they went looking for the source of the system in the physical realm, the basement, they were being actively monitored by the will of the system, which was entirely external to the location they were investigating.
If she wasn't in the basement where her secrets were stored, then where was she? Behind us implies a constant shadowing presence, enforcing the rules from the periphery.
It's entirely outside the realm of physical accountability or geographical confinement. It suggests the system wasn't reliant on her physical body at all. The list was the artifact, the rules were the force, and Miss Applebottom was simply the lingering will that directed them.
She achieved a form of bureaucratic immortality.
Yes. The officers were looking for the past in the basement. But the present threat was still actively enforcing the rules right over their shoulder.
The terrifying implication is that the fire, which was supposed to be the end of her tyranny, was just the catalyst for her transformation into a far more effective and deadly enforcer.
The town burned down the physical librarian, but they failed to erase the idea, the system, or the personality that gave it power.
Which brings us to the wrap-up. This case shows that some forms of obsession, like an unyielding devotion to due dates and order, can transcend expected boundaries, including death.
When the enforcer is gone, the rule remains. And sometimes, that rule needs a method of enforcement. In Port Royal, that method was silent strangulation commanded by a checklist.
So, to quickly recap this absolutely wild 1867 timeline, we had the strict 94-year-old librarian, Miss Applebottom, running her world with an iron fist, fueled by the rage of late returns.
Then the fiery erasure of her life in library by a cannonball.
Next, the systemic strangulation of overdue borrowers days later, tracked by that horrifying checklist.
And finally, the discovery of the hidden command center beneath the ruins, confirming her operations were far darker than anyone suspected.
Yet she was nowhere to be found because she was behind the search team.
What this 1867 case tells us about control is fundamentally unsettling. Miss Applebottom was so devoted to the principle of order that she managed to create a self-sustaining force that demanded closure for every administrative oversight. The system, the haunting, the echo, they all continued to operate long after she was physically gone.
Sometimes the structure of a system is so complete, so rigid, that its inertia just carries it forward, through destruction and through death. The idea of the fine becomes the weapon, and the ledger becomes the judge.
And that leads us to our final horrifying takeaway from the Port Royal incident.
Sometimes the person you think you buried is still the one checking names off the list.
And since the source material implies we can find similar cases like this, it encourages us to look deeper into the nature of human accountability and bureaucracy. We explored overdue books today, but you have to consider what other mundane, deeply held human rules might survive their creator. Well, like the eternal obligation of debt, the meticulous records of social slights, or unquestioning obedience to a forgotten command. Could they become something equally monstrous?
What other list is still being maintained out there, silently dictating consequences for rules long forgotten? That's a thought to keep you up at night, especially when that library fine reminder pops up in your email.
Indeed. A fascinating deep dive into a case that proves bureaucracy, when executed with enough personal zeal, can achieve lethal, eternal persistence.
Full breakdown and more cases pulled from the edges of history at Inspector Story. We'll see you next time.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.